Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for April 20th and 21st, 2012, from sundown to sundown. This teaching is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this message. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord my God, King of the universe, who is the creator of all things. Holy is your name. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth, Abba, as it is in heaven, and in our lives as well. May you regather the exiles back to your land. And may you remember your covenant with Abraham on our behalf, Abba. And I thank you for this week's Torah portion and for your people who have for the last 3,500 years preserved your Torah for us to have at this end of days. And I pray for their safety in Jerusalem and in Israel. And I pray that they will see their Messiah coming through the clouds. And I pray for your people all over the earth. And I just ask that you bless the people who are listening to Torah portions everywhere, and may the words that I speak be only your words, Abba. I ask in the name of Yeshua. Amen. This week's Torah portion is called Shemini. It means eighth. And it's Leviticus chapter 9, verse 1 to chapter 11, verse 47. The Haftarah is 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 1 to chapter 7, verse 17. And the Brit HaDashah is Acts 10, verse 9 to 22 and 34 and 35. Let's start at Leviticus chapter 9, verse 1. And it came to pass on the eighth day that Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. Well, this is the eighth day. Now, what is this particular eighth day? Well, it is the first day after the altar's been sanctified for that 7-day period. You remember that 7-day period of sanctification, the process they had to go through for 7 days, and the purification of the priests. You remember that they had to stay in the tabernacle for 7 days. Well, this is a type and shadow, another type and shadow of the wedding. The priests, and you know, which is also the bride, have spent 7 days and nights with Yeshua, the groom, in their new house. And the tabernacle is now going through the process of being set apart from the rest of Israel and the rest of the world. You know how you set apart your house from everybody else, and now this is your space. Well, that's a kind of a type and shadow of that what happened in that 7-day period. And of course, this is how it's going to be for the bride in the kingdom, who are also the sons of Zadok, you know, that type and shadow priestly line of Levites that will include members from all 12 tribes. But another thing that happened on the first day was that God began to create the earth. The eighth day and the first day are actually, in a sense, they are the same day. And so they are related. Well, on the eighth day, you have gone through a cycle, and now you have another first day, which is also the eighth day. And so the number seven has to do with the creation cycle. But the eighth day has a broader concept than that first day, in that the eighth day is not just new beginnings. It also means the circumference. In other words, after the creation, then comes the inclusion of everything into God's plan. Now, we just came through Passover, and so this event now in Leviticus 9:1 is going to seem a little bit out of place, because this event takes place on the first day of Aviv, which, as you know, the ancient Babylonian system you know, the Jews changed that first month to Nisan, but the Bible calls it Aviv. And so that's when this chapter 9 of Leviticus takes place, is on the first day of Aviv, and that's 2 weeks before Passover. Now let's go to verse 2. And he said to Aaron, take a young calf for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering without blemish, and offer them before the Lord. And to the children of Israel you shall speak, saying, take a kid of the goats for a sin offering, and a calf, and a lamb, both of the first year, without blemish, for a burnt offering, also a bullock and a ram for peace offerings to sacrifice before the Lord, and a meat offering mingled with oil, for today the Lord will appear unto you. And they brought that which Moses commanded before the tabernacle of the congregation, and all the congregation drew near and stood before the Lord. So here we see that the priest makes a sin offering for himself, and the people have to do their sin offerings. And Moses tells them how to get the glory of the Lord to appear to them. Now, until now, Moses and a few other folks out of the roughly 2.5 or 3 million people that were there had been the only people to see the glory of the Lord. But now Moses gives instruction to everyone on how to get to see the glory of the Lord. And here's what he said in Leviticus 9, verse 6. And Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord commanded that you should do, and the glory of the Lord shall appear to you. So you see, those instructions that he just gave to the children of Israel to come forward with their goats for a sin offering and a calf and a lamb for a burnt offering, that is having something to do with the glory of the Lord appearing to them. Now, here's the secret, and it's in verse 7. And Moses said to Aaron, go to the altar and offer your sin offering and your burnt offering, and make an atonement for yourself and for the people. And offer the offering of the people, and make an atonement for them as the Lord commanded. Well, hey, that's the secret. We have to come to God's altar. You see, that's the secret. Now, since we don't have the stone altar that we can approach, we have to use the altar that's in our hearts, because God made us to be individual temples. Now, you know, some folks say that because now we have individual temples, and collectively, as the body of Yeshua, we are the temple, that there's not going to be any other temple. Some people literally do say that. That's not true. We will have the temple in three places in the kingdom, and here are the places. We're going to have them in our individual bodies. We're going to have our individual bodies, when we get our new bodies, those will still be temples to the Lord. And collectively, God's people will be a nation of priests, and collectively we will be a temple. And then there's going to be a physical constructed building built by the Messiah that will also have the altar, and that is going to be a temple. So we're going to have an altar in that temple, and we have altars in our hearts. We have an altar in our heart, and we have an altar amongst us collectively, and so we can approach the altar, and the glory of the Lord will appear to us. Now, There have been people who have said that the Torah is all about the letter of the law. Well, it's not. It's about the heart. Because if you don't have a physical altar in Jerusalem, the only way to approach the Lord is through your heart, which is your altar. And, you know, even Aaron had to have a heart to know God, or he would not have qualified to go before the stone altar. You see, the heart is the altar of flesh. The stone altar is the altar of stone. So, Aaron had to have a heart of flesh in order to qualify to go before the altar. And so the Torah is all about the heart. And it's about how we approach the Lord. So, you know, for those who say that the Torah is not about the heart, but is a cold and dead thing about just keeping the letter of the law with no spirit, that's not true. Now, from verses 8 to 22, we are given the details of how Aaron did that first offering. And then there's some other instruction that comes to us that is absolutely amazing, and it starts in verse 23. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation and came out and blessed the people. And guess what happened? Just as the Lord said, if you come and you bring your offerings to the altar, the glory of the Lord will appear to you. And guess what happened in verse 23? And the glory of the Lord appeared to some of the people. No, the men. No, all of the people. Now, the Lord appeared to all of the people, men, women, and children. There are people in this world that teach women cannot approach God, much less see His glory. Those people don't know what they're talking about. And now, I'm not going to mention the names of those supposedly Christian organizations and their doctrines, but there are a few of them around. But you see, God appears to all the people. I just wanted you to understand that. So when the glory fell, something happened. In verse 24, and it says, there came a fire out from before the Lord and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and the fat, which, when all the people saw, they shouted and fell on their faces. Now, at first glance, we might think that seeing the fire come from the Lord scared the people, and that's why they shouted and fell on their faces. But we need to look at a particular Hebrew word in that verse, and that verse, that word is the word shout. It's Strong's 74:42, and it's the Hebrew word ranan. Now, what it means is to emit a stridulous sound, is the way it says in Strong's dictionary, but it means to shout, usually for joy, aloud for joy, cry out, be joyful, greatly, make to rejoice, cause to shout for joy, cause to sing aloud for joy, triumph. So this shouting that they were doing was because they were joyful, and it made them fall on their faces. So that they fell on their faces not because of fear, but from joy and even possibly triumph. And they fell on their faces to worship. Now, why would they act this way? Because, you know, previously, they had not had a good history with the Lord. So why would this fire make them shout for joy? You know, God had almost wiped them out, right? And they knew that He didn't want to lead them anymore. And they knew Moses had to intercede for them. I'm sure that they knew all of this stuff. Now, there had to have been an angst amongst the people about whether or not God would still show himself to them. So that's the reason that they shouted for joy, or that they shouted in triumph, and fell on their faces. It was because they had a great joy and gladness that Jehovah was still their God, and they were still his people. That's why he showed his glory to them, so that they would now understand that he is still their God, and they are still his people, you see? So that's the proper understanding of that there. It's not that they were scared and were frightened and fell on their faces to hide their faces from the Lord. No, it was triumph and worship. But then, of course, in the very next verse, which comes in Leviticus 10:1, comes Nadab and Abihu with their own fire, because they wanted to be big shots. They wanted to show the people that they, the priesthood, could control the fire. Let's go to Leviticus 10:1. And Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer, and put fire therein, and put incense thereon, and offered strange fire before Jehovah, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire from Jehovah, and devoured them, and they died before Jehovah. Now, I know that what I just said about them, you know, wanting to be the big shots and control the fire, is not the usual way that this story is interpreted. And I am not discounting those other interpretations. But I just happen to think there's more to this than what we're being taught. I just happen to think that in Nadab and Abihu was hubris. And not just from drinking too much wine or being too influenced by their former paganness in Egypt, if you will. But I'm talking about actual ego involved, in that those two probably wanted to get some of the glory that the people were giving to the Lord for themselves. Now, why do I think that? Well, they just came out of Egypt. They just came out of a place that was full of paganism. And one of the practices of pagan priests and priestesses has long been the use of controlling the elements. If you have a shaman or a magician that can control wind, water, and fire, then he or she is able to also control the people. You see, that's what the magicians in Egypt demonstrated when they kept trying to mimic what God was doing. You see, every time God did a miracle in Egypt, and the magicians were able to mimic it, the people were not fazed one iota. And the magicians, the priests of the demonic Egyptian religions, maintained their control over the people. It wasn't until the magicians were outdone by the Lord, which didn't take long, that the priests began to lose control of the people of Egypt, making it possible for them to decide to come out of Egypt with the Hebrews and to be grafted into the commonwealth of Israel. So now we have Nadab and Abihu, who I think were trying to be magicians instead of priests. They were attempting to show the people that they could do the same thing. They could control the fire, and they could do that in order to make the people subservient to them as a priesthood, like the priests, the magicians were in Egypt, instead of getting the people to serve the Lord. You see, that is what I think this episode is about. In fact, this next verse, verse 3, explains more of what I just said. Then Moses said to Aaron, "This is what Jehovah spoke, saying, I will be sanctified in them that come near to me, and before all the people I will be glorified." And Aaron held his peace. What did the Lord say? The Lord said, "I am going to be the one to be sanctified in the people that come near to me, and I am the one that's going to be glorified." Why would he have to say that unless Nadab and Abihu were there trying to be the one that got sanctified from the people? You know, they would get their glory from the people, keeping the Lord from having the sanctified, set-apart people and the glory. You see, and Aaron held his peace because he knew his sons were having an ego trip there in front of the altar. So the Lord is actually saying that Nadab and Abihu were trying to sanctify themselves, and that they were trying to take away the glory that God had just given to the people, that, you know, that he had just shown to the people. And Nadab and Abihu wanted that glory for themselves. Now, you know, we have a lot of that going on in our churches and synagogues today. Ministers trying to sanctify themselves and make themselves holy through whatever it is they think they control, and wanting to get the glory that belongs to God for the things that they do. Alright, so then in verse 9 we have the prohibition about not drinking wine or strong drink before coming to the Lord. And this is, you know, the normal teaching is that they were killed because they offered strange fire and incense, something that the Lord did not command them, and then it was disobedience, and they committed the disobedience because they had been drinking and were probably drunk. Well, let's read verse 9 and then I'll say some more. "Do not drink wine nor strong drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go to the tabernacle of the congregation, lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations." You see, I have no doubt that what those teachers have taught for thousands of years about that is true. But here's the thing. I think that the teaching doesn't go far enough, because Nadab and Abihu's egos were fueled by the drink that had made them high. So being drunk leads to impaired judgment. And, you know, it usually brings out the worst in us, as I'm sure was the case here with Nadab and Abihu. So that's why we see this here about not drinking. And in verse 10 it says, "And that you may put difference between set apart and unset apart, and between clean and unclean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which Jehovah has spoken to them by the hand of Moses." You can't maintain composure and sanctity and stay clean and teach properly when you're drunk. Drinking and trying to serve the Lord will always lead to the ego coming out, wanting to get the glory that belongs to the Lord. So what I'm saying here is not that we shouldn't drink. You know, wine is holy. I drink wine. I drink other strong drinks too. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when you are serving at the altar, when you are serving the Lord, you don't drink before you go to do that. I don't drink wine before I get on this recording and start trying to teach you. You see, you don't drink and try to serve at the altar. It's like the old adage, don't drink and drive. Well, you don't drink and serve at the altar, you see. And now, since the Lord has brought up the subject of clean and unclean, we're just going to have to move along, because he wants to explain and give the definition of what that is in chapter 11. Now, I'm sure that you've read chapter 11 before, and if you read it, I hope that you're practicing it. This chapter is not about animals that are good or bad. It is about God's list of what is fit food for a human body. God designed the human body. He knows what will fuel it and nourish it the best and keep it clean. We do not. We're like goats. We'll put anything in here that we think tastes good, and sometimes if it doesn't taste good, we'll just deliberately keep eating it until we acquire a taste for it. And when we do that, we acquire a dislike for the good greens, veggies, and fruits that are good for us. Have you ever noticed that there are no plants on either the clean or the unclean list? That's because all plants have a nourishing quality even if they are poisonous. Every poisonous plant has some part of it that can be used for our good. Not so with unclean meat, fish, and insects. So this Torah portion leaves us with this, Leviticus 11, verse 46. This is the law of the beasts and of the fowl and of every living creature that moves in the waters and of every creature that creeps upon the earth to make a difference between the unclean and the clean and between the beast that may be eaten and the beast that may not be eaten. That's what that whole chapter is about. God describes it in full detail and then sums it up very nicely at the end. You see, He provides everything for us if we obey Him. And all He wants from us is to give Him the glory that most people would take for themselves. Shabbat Shalom.